Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Shifting fronts in U.S. involvement in the Middle East, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper revealed that American troops leaving Syria are not coming home, but instead they are headed to Iraq. Meanwhile, the attempt at a U.S.-brokered ceasefire between Turkey and Syrian Kurds did little to assuage the deep fears of the Kurds in the region. So what did the temporary agreement achieve, if anything? This hour On Point, we'll get the latest on the turmoil in Syria. And you can join us. What's your reaction to the decision to move troops from northern Syria to Iraq? What's your question for folks there on the ground? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, let's listen first to a little bit from Secretary of Defense Mark Esper talking about the president's decision to withdraw troops from Syria. The president's move has been framed by the administration as a decision to get troops home and out of, quote, endless wars. But Secretary Esper said that troops from Syria are being relocated to Western Iraq.
The current game plan is for those forces to reposition into Western Iraq and then to two missions. One is to help defend Iraq, and two is to perform a counter-ISIS mission as we sort through the next steps.
That's the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper. Well, joining us now from Washington is Laura Seligman, Pentagon correspondent for foreign policy. Laura, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us what more we know about these U.S. troops that have been reported as crossing the border from Syria into Iraq. What's actually going on?
So what's going on right now is that the U.S. is pretty much making a hasty withdrawal from Syria. We had about 1,000 troops in northern Syria left a couple weeks ago, and after the president's decision to move troops from the border, which essentially green-lighted the Turkish invasion, we've sped up our withdrawal. So we have, I believe there's the U.S. troops are consolidating into two points in northern Syria, one in the east and one in the west. In the east, they are now moving out by land, by convoy, and perhaps possibly helicopter to western Iraq. And then over in the west of northern Syria, sort of near Kobani, they're moving out by airlift. So this is sort of the end of almost the end of U.S. presence in northern Syria, although there was news last night that broke that the president is considering a plan, which I believe was presented by Senator Lindsey Graham, to leave a couple hundred, maybe 200, 300 perhaps, in northern Syria, primarily to guard the oil fields, which are currently under Kurdish control, from getting into Syrian President Bashar Assad's hands. And then they would also have a counter-ISIS mission, although it's not clear to me what 200 troops can do against both ISIS and Assad's army.
Okay, well, so let's listen then. You mentioned Senator Lindsey Graham. Let's listen to what he said yesterday on Fox News, because, of course, for the past couple of weeks, Senator Graham has been very vocally critical of President Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria. But here's what he said yesterday on Fox News.
I am increasingly optimistic that we can have some historic solutions in Syria that have eluded us for years if we play our cards right.
So, Laura, I mean, do we know what more Graham is talking about? Why his sudden change of heart and that we can all of a sudden play our cards right?
I think he's probably trying to walk a fine line between what the president wants, which is obviously to get U.S. troops home, get them out of Syria, get them out of the Middle East, and then securing U.S. interests in Syria. So we're actually leaving, even before this latest plan, we had been leaving a couple hundred, maybe 150 troops in southern Syria at a small outpost called Al-Tanf, which sort of acting as a buffer for Iran's presence in Syria. It's a very small garrison that's on the border with Jordan. Jordan, where we have a very small base of troops. So that was always sort of in the cards. And now we have President Trump making another kind of reversal, deciding to leave a couple hundred troops in northern Syria. I think that what Lindsey Graham is trying to do is trying to, on the one hand, please the president and allow him to fulfill his campaign promises, while on the other hand, keeping a residual force in Syria, which is really critical to having a stable northern Syria. I mean, the Kurds that are there are already, civilians are dying. 400,000, I believe, civilians have been displaced. And if this security zone agreement with Turkey holds, it could be more and more people are displaced from that area. And you have so many interests, so many players there. You have Turkey coming in, but you also have the Syrian army. You also have the Syrian rebels, the Free Syrian Army, and other Turkish-backed forces that have been wreaking havoc. So it's a chaotic region right now, and the presence of U.S. forces are going to be critical to stabilizing it.
Well, so you mentioned this ceasefire that was brokered by the U.S. last week. I mean, just let's listen to a moment to former Ambassador William Burns, who served as ambassador to Russia and as the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State in the Obama administration. He was on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, and he was critical of the Trump administration's moves in the past couple of weeks, saying that the administration's policy could be very long-lasting in the region.
I mean, I think there was a smart way and a dumb way to deal with what was a very complicated situation in which we had modest leverage in northeast Syria. I think we chose the dumb way. In one impulsive presidential phone call, we, in a sense, gave away our leverage. And then in a pretty hasty negotiated ceasefire, we threw the Kurds under the bus.
It's former Ambassador William Burns on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday. Laura, so things seem to be moving so quickly that I just wonder if you might just help us walk through whether or not the ceasefire actually was a ceasefire.
So as of Friday, when the ceasefire was agreed, it certainly was not a ceasefire. There were reports all Friday and over the weekend that the Turkish-backed forces continued shelling the border city of Ras Al Ain. And in fact, they encircled the city and would not let medical convoys come in, which were trying to come in and evacuate wounded civilians. And I've been in touch with the Kurdish Red Crescent, which is one of the only, I think, medical convoys, medical humanitarian groups that is still on the ground there. It's just simply too dangerous for most international groups. I've been in touch with them, and they were trying to get in all weekend, and they told me that many people, in fact, died due to loss of blood and getting the help that they needed. I'm told that just yesterday, I believe, there was another group, an American group, that was able to get in and evacuate some of the civilians there. But in general, it's just a horrible situation. I think in the last 24 hours, the fighting has ceased a little bit. Although there are still reports of some fighting, there is not as much shelling or bombing. So I have hope right now that this ceasefire is going to hold, and that will allow some time for the Kurdish forces, the YPG militia, to pull back, which is they have agreed to do under the ceasefire agreement. But I am still very concerned about all the civilians that have been caught up in this. There were reports, and I got horrific pictures from Ras Al Ain, civilians from Ras Al Ain who had escaped, but with horrible chemical burns on their faces and torsos. These are children, and it looks like the Turkish-backed proxies are using white phosphorus and potentially other chemicals against civilians. So these war crimes are being committed, atrocities are happening, and it's just an awful situation.
Chemical weapons attacks, you're saying, on civilians and children.
Technically, white phosphorus is not a chemical weapon. There's a lot of legalities in that term. In fact, it's not banned in military use, but it is a war crime if used against civilians. So lots of technicalities there. But if you're a person who has been burned with white phosphorus, I think that the technicalities don't really matter.
And so then, I mean, you talked about the Syrian forces, the Kurdish-backed forces. I mean, where... what group, if any, is ostensibly protecting the civilians as you said, some 400,000 being or having already been displaced?
So the civilians who are mostly Kurdish in this area are being protected to the extent that they can by the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is the Kurdish-led group that had until recently partnered with the United States to defeat ISIS. This group, it's very complicated, lots of webs of interconnections in this region, but this group is primarily led by the YPG militia, which has links to the PKK, which is a terrorist organization in Turkey that has been waging an insurgency in Turkey for the last couple decades. So it's certainly fair for Turkey to see the PKK as a terrorist threat, and so that's their view of the YPG, the SDF. But the reality on the ground is that the SDF, the Syrian YPG, the Syrian militia, has not waged any attacks on Turkey from Syria. In fact, what they've been doing is protecting civilians, protecting U.S. forces, frankly, in Syria. We've lost, I think, 4 U.S. soldiers in total since 2014 in Syria. Compare that to somewhere like Afghanistan, where blue-on-green attacks are common, and the SDF has been a really good ally in the region. So it's complicated, but the SDF, as they keep saying, they are not terrorists, and I think they would object to that. To that appearance.
I see. But I'm seeing from your reporting, Laura, that the president of the Syrian Democratic Council made an emergency trip to Washington very recently to meet with U.S. officials. We've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break, Laura, but tell us about that.
Yeah, so there were some reports that General Maslam, who is the commander of the Syrian Democratic Forces, he was going to come to D.C. to talk to U.S. officials, but he has opted to remain with his fighters at a base in Syria, and he has sent his envoy, who is Ilham Ahmed. She is the president of the Syrian Democratic Council, which is the political arm of the SDF, and she arrived in D.C., I believe, yesterday, and she's going to be meeting with her, I'm sure, making her case and pleading with the U.S. to leave at least a residual presence in northern Syria.
Okay, well, Laura Seligman, stand by for just a second. Laura is the Pentagon correspondent for foreign policy, and we are talking about the latest moves of U.S. troops in northern Syria and the impact that withdrawal is having in the region. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the latest movement of U.S. troops in northern Syria and the impact that's having in Syria and the region as a whole, and asking whether this marks a permanent reduction in U.S. clout in the region. I'm joined today by Laura Seligman. She is Pentagon correspondent for foreign policy, and she joins us today from Washington. We want to hear from you. What's your question about what's happening in Syria? You probably heard that Syrian Kurds are protesting as the U.S. evacuates its last major base in northern Syria. Here's a moment where one woman explained why she's protesting. She spoke to ABC News.
We are here for our families who are besieged. We hope they'll be able to flee from there, and our wounded will be able to get out as well.
Syrian Kurdish woman speaking to ABC News. Let's go to Roberta, who's calling from Southborough, Massachusetts. Roberta, you're on the air.
Hi, Magda. I just had a few comments.
One was, you know, it just seems like it makes no sense whatsoever to leave Syria and abandon the Kurds, who then can't guard the ISIS troops and the ISIS prisoners, and then the ISIS prisoners escape, and then we're sending the troops down to Iraq to go fight ISIS. It's like, okay, you let them out one side of the barn, and then you run down to the other end of the yard. I mean, it just makes no sense at all. There's that. And then the horrible abandonment of the Kurds, which is for the second time, at least, I believe, in history. They keep trusting us, then we keep throwing them to the wind, you know, letting them twist in the wind. And that's just really not going to do much for our reputation in the area. And then secondly, I wanted to, my thought first before I got the another thought was, you know, it has occurred to me that this president would not be above trying to start a war in order to keep his position of power. I don't see that. Other people would avoid doing that, but this guy wouldn't.
Mm. Well, Roberta, I'm going to. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but you've said a lot. I want Laura Seligman, who is the Pentagon correspondent, to chime in here on some of what you said, Roberta. Thank you for your call, Laura. First of all, I mean, Roberta kind of started her comments there by asking what I think is a fundamental question. Like right now, do you gather that the U.S. actually has a strategy in northern Syria?
To me, on the outside, it doesn't seem that way. I know that none of the president's advisors would have advised him to do this. It really doesn't cost us very much to keep Turkey out of Syria. The argument that's being made is that Turkey was going to launch an attack anyway. This was going to happen, and we just had to get our troops out of the way. Personally, I don't buy that. Turkey has been threatening to launch attacks across the border for months now, and we've always stood our ground alongside the SDF. I've talked to soldiers who have been on the ground in Syria fighting alongside the SDF saying, you know, I was in Manbij when Turkey threatened to come across the border. We stood our ground. Nothing happened. So I am highly skeptical of the belief that if U.S. troops were on the border, Turkey would have come in knowing that they would kill U.S. troops. I'm highly skeptical of that. So, again, it doesn't cost us very much to keep 50 to 100 U.S. troops on the border with Syria to keep the Kurds safe. Of course, now that is totally out of the window. Roberta is definitely correct in saying that ISIS prisoners are escaping. Across Syria, you have, I believe, at least 70,000, maybe upwards of 100,000 of ISIS family members who were in camps across the region, not just children, but also women who actually, they were often the female fighters in ISIS. And then you also have, I think, around 10,000 ISIS fighters themselves coming from all over Syria, Iraq, America, Europe, held in prisons that were guarded by the SDF. And with this Turkish advance, a lot of those people have been escaping. They've gone into hiding. They've gone with the Turkish-backed forces, many of whom actually have ties to terrorist groups like al-Nusra. So who knows what's going to happen to these people. And last I talked with Pentagon officials, they couldn't say how many ISIS fighters had escaped and where these people had gone to. So they just seem to have completely lost control.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Barbara, who's calling from Sarasota, Florida. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hello, everybody. I got to say something. You may not like what I'm going to say, but I'm with President Trump to remove our troops from harm's way. We don't need any more young men coming back without arms and legs. I'd rather they be Syrians and Kurds, to be honest. Not that I want anyone hurt. However, knock it off with the U.S. having to guard everyone and every border. That is ridiculous. And by the way, we've got to get straightened up in this country. Right now, they're picking on Giuliani so much. And you know what? He handled the mafia. Why don't you trust him a little bit, everybody? Huh? He might know about corruption, you know? Mm. And there is no reason that someone like Biden, who's just a politician, is worth that much.
Yeah.
What did he do? What did he invent? And what did he sell?
Hey, Barbara, let me take it back from you there because we're talking about Syria right now. And I appreciate your comments there. I want to turn them to Laura. You know, look, we'll definitely talk about Washington politics in the days forward. I'm sure about that. But Laura, I mean, Barbara, they're echoing a very strong sentiment amongst a lot of Americans, and it's part of one of the deep impulses that the president has long had. I mean, he has talked about wanting to remove troops, U.S. troops, from facing the dangers of these endless wars. I guess the question is how much is that impulse competing with the sort of the strategic requirements of how to best do that? And how is the Pentagon sort of handling how the president acts and thinks through how he wants to end U.S. involvement in the region?
Well, Barbara, I think you're absolutely right that we should bring U.S. troops home to the extent that we can. But the key thing to remember here in Syria is that these troops are not going home. Trump is not bringing them home. He is sending them to Iraq to fight ISIS. So they're in just as much danger there fighting ISIS as they were before in Syria. The difference now is that he purposely moved them out of the way to let Turkey come in and basically ethnically cleanse Syria of the Kurds and the YPG fighters. So it just seems like very unnecessary violence and death happening simply because the president decided to move troops to another location in the Middle East. Again, they're not actually coming home. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is that, yes, this is a very tricky balance for the Pentagon to strike in terms of, on the one hand, meeting the president's campaign promise to bring U.S. troops home. You see this in Afghanistan also. But on the other hand, we do have interests in the region. First of all, against terrorism. We don't want another 9/11 to happen, and we don't want this group, ISIS, which is even worse than Al-Qaeda was to some extent, we don't want them able to gain a foothold in Iraq and Syria and other places in the Middle East as they had done in 2014, because that gives them more ability to conduct terrorist activities, not just in the U.S., but all over the place, the Philippines, Europe. So we do have interests there. We can't just stay in our country. The terrorism is global now, so it's a tricky balance. But I think the Pentagon and the administration are still finding their way.
Well, let's go to Lane, who's calling from Tarpon Springs, Florida. Lane, you're on the air.
Right. My question is, if we pull troops out of Syria with no reason at all, with a tweet, and then we see the president of Turkey and the president of Russia meeting together, does that sound like something that's not kosher? I don't think it's kosher. And there's Kurds who've been our friends for years and years, and we've left them in the dust.
Yeah.
If we were in Europe and did this to Belgium and did this to France, where would we be now with the Nazis?
Yeah. Lane, thank you so much for your call. Laura, you want to respond to him?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think you have a really good point, Lane. I think that more than anything, this move to move U.S. forces out of Syria does is give Russia even more of a toehold in the region. And if you go back to 2013, when President Obama, something he's often criticized for, failed to act when Bashar Assad was gassing his people, and that allowed Russia to step in, and now Russia is one of Assad's main backers. So now this latest move is letting Russia into not just sort of western and southern Syria, but also now into northern Syria, because the Kurds, the only option they had was to backfill the gap left with U.S. forces, with Syria's army and Russian troops. This will not only let Russia come in, but it'll also let Iran come in more. And that's also something that the U.S. is very concerned about. So I think that it's all bad if you have Russia as the main power broker in the region.
Well, I just want to listen to a little bit more from what members of the administration themselves have been saying recently. Just thinking back to that ceasefire between Turkey and Kurdish groups, that was the attempted ceasefire that was broken by Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Now, initially, their efforts did receive quite a bit of criticism from Republicans and Democrats for being too lenient on Turkey. But here's how Secretary of State Mike Pompeo responded on ABC's This Week just yesterday, when host George Stephanopoulos asked the secretary if it seemed that that Turkey got, quote, everything they wanted.
It sure didn't feel that way when we were negotiating. It was a hard-fought negotiation. It began before the vice president and I even arrived in Ankara. It lasted hours while we were there. we achieved the outcome that President Trump sent us to achieve.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday. From the other side of the aisle, Democratic Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey said he disagreed with Pompeo's assessment of stability in the region. Here he is, also on ABC's This Week.
I see it totally different. I was at that White House meeting, and I have to tell you, when the President of the United States says we shouldn't worry about 7,000 miles away and those terrorists there, well, on September 11th, they traveled over 7,000 miles.
Now, Menendez, they're referring to a contentious meeting between the president and top Democrats on Wednesday about Syria. Now, let's go to Nancy, who's calling from Braintree, Massachusetts. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, in regard to the American troops and their families, were they told that they were coming home and then days later told, nope, sorry, they're going to a more dangerous place? Thank you very much.
Yeah. Nancy, thanks for your call. Laura, do you have any insight on that?
I don't have a specific answer to that. I'm not sure what U.S. troops on the ground were told because it's very close hold. These guys are very hard to reach right now. What I do know is that they are certainly in harm's way right now and have been in over the last week or two. They're in much more danger than they were previously. Obviously, these are special forces guys that can take care of themselves. And in fact, many of them want to be out there helping their Kurdish partners fight these awful Turkish proxies that are attacking them. But they, they were given their orders and they hunkered down at the two outposts that I spoke about. And from there, I think they were sort of just in limbo the past couple weeks. I think originally there was definitely reporting that they were told they were coming home, but it's not clear to me that they were given exact orders before now they're going out to Iraq. Mm.
Now, Laura, you mentioned Iran and Russia. Obviously, we've talked in depth about Turkey and the plight that the Kurds find themselves in, all because of the president's decision to withdraw what is a relatively smallish number of U.S. troops. Now, they're in a very, very important region. But Mike, I guess the question I want to ask is, I mean, what does this say about U.S. influence and clout right now in Syria that in fact, the withdrawal of a small number of troops could trigger such a cascade of events and reactions thereafter? And does this mean sort of a permanent shift in U.S. influence in the region?
Yeah, I think, again, as I sort of explained in the beginning, it's a very small number of troops, like you said, but in a very strategic position. So the border between Turkey and Syria, having U.S. troops there, it was essentially a deterrent for Turkey not to go in and do what they're doing now, which is killing civilians and fighters and displacing people and using chemicals on civilians. And I think that was a catastrophic failure of the administration to think through their actions. And it does say to me that the U.S. values Turkey as a partner more than the Kurds. And that's something that perhaps might be, might not be controversial, but Turkey is a NATO ally and the Kurds are not a state. They are an ethnic group. And although the SDF, the SDC, has created a fragile democracy in northern Syria, which is more than can be said for many of our previous partners in the region, they are not a state. So on the face of it, that might not be surprising. But Turkey has not been a great ally of late. In addition to this incursion in Syria, they have also been bought Russian missile defense equipment, which we explicitly told them not to buy because it's a threat to our fighter jets and the rest of NATO air defenses. What they held Pastor Brunson for a long time, although they did release him. So there's an argument to be made that Turkey is not being a good ally right now, and they're moving more toward Russia than ever before. So I think it's really a question of where do our values lie and what are U.S. interests in the region, and are we really going to lose clout in the region because of this decision?
Yeah, well, I want to sneak in one last call before we run out of time with you, Laura. Let's go to Karen, who's calling from Hudson, Massachusetts. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering if your guests, what your guests might think of this idea, that Turkey has been clamoring still for some answers about the murder of Khashoggi, And, it seems like Trump has been wanting to sort of shield Saudi Arabia from having to give any answers about that. And I'm just wondering if this could have some kind of backroom, you know, like, I'll just give you Turkey this. I'll give Turkey the Kurds so they'll shut up about Khashoggi.
Well, thank you. Karen, thank you for your call. Laura, do you dare to venture a guess on that?
I think that that certainly raises an interesting point, but I think that the issue with the Kurds is a separate issue than the Khashoggi issue. I think that Turkey has long had an issue with the U.S. backing the Kurds. Like I said before, they see the YPG in Syria as a terrorist group, an offshoot of the PKK, which has been labeled a terrorist group in Turkey. Again, I would say that they're is a bit of a difference. There's a nuance. We don't view the SDF as terrorists, obviously, but I think that ever since the Obama administration began working with the SDF a couple years ago to fight ISIS, Turkey did not like that. And then President Trump's decision 2 years ago to give them weapons and small arms that inflamed Turkey even more.
Well, Laura Seligman, Pentagon correspondent with Foreign Policy, speaking to us from Washington. Laura, thank you so much for walking us through the ever-changing and rapidly changing situation in Syria. Thanks a lot, Laura.
Thanks so much.
Well, when we come back, speaking of ever-changing, we'll get the latest on Brexit from London. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Every time we've had a Brexit conversation on this show, or quite frankly, in conversations I've heard in almost any other show, someone inevitably says, we're in uncharted territory. So if there's any truism about Brexit, I would say that is it. And the UK continues to sail into that uncharted territory. On Saturday, Parliament forced Prime Minister Boris Johnson to request a Brexit extension from the European Union. Johnson says he wants a vote on his Brexit deal as soon as possible, but that is not totally in his control, and lots is happening in Parliament right now about exactly this issue. So you can join the conversation. We want to hear from you. Have you been following Brexit for the past 3 years? Are you a British expat who might be affected by Brexit? What's your question for what might happen next in the United Kingdom? And for example, we've got a comment already on our website from someone saying, what is this, Brexit V25? Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us now from London is Rob Watson. He's the UK political correspondent for the BBC World Service. Rob, it is great to have you back. And let me just ask you right now, I think it's good to have you. Are you breathless in terms of all that's been happening in Parliament today? Like just now, the Speaker of the House of Commons made a pretty key decision.
Well, I've been fairly breathless these last 3.5 years, but actually I wasn't that breathless because A, I'm not surprised by what the Speaker has done, and B, I just don't think it's quite the bigger deal that that the British media had sort of had it set up to be, because essentially what the Speaker has done, and everyone's going to have to bear with me for a brief second here, he said, look, we're not going to repeat what we did on Saturday, which was have a vote on whether you think the sort of the principle of this deal that Mr. Johnson reached with the European Union Union last week. We're not going to have a vote on that because we already did that on Saturday, and Parliament came to the conclusion, guess what, not yes or no, but not yet. Okay. And so what I think the government, but the reason why I don't think it's the end of the world for the government, it doesn't mean that their deal is dead. It means what the government must now do is come along with the actual law, this big piece of legislation that would enact that deal. So in many ways, if I was to make things as simple as I possibly could in British politics, I think this is the moment we've arrived at. So Mr. Johnson did this deal with the European Union last week, and it seems to me between now and the 31st of October, we'll find out whether there is actually just about a majority in Parliament to turn that deal into a law, either on the 31st of October when Britain is supposed to leave, or maybe a bit of a longer extension, or whether any parliamentary majority that exists for this deal is so fragile and so small that the rough and tumble of getting complex legislation through the British Parliament just proves too much of a challenge over the next 10 days, and that the process collapses, and that essentially then we have to go for a general election. So, long-winded way of saying, I think we're either on our way to a deal close to the 31st of October or a little bit after, or the whole process just collapses.
Okay, Rob, so I'm just going to be honest and say that I personally feel a lot of confusion about where the UK is right now, and I can only imagine how people
Can I interrupt you briefly? You know, I think there was a period when my wife was just incredibly busy, and she said, you know, goodness, I just need to catch up. So I'm a bit confused about the Brexit process. And I said to my wife, the thing about Brexit, if you're not confused, it means you haven't been paying attention properly.
Good. So that makes
I got that wrong. I ruined my own punchline. If you've been paying attention properly, you will be confused.
Okay, right. Good. You're forgiven for confusing your own punchline. In this. It seems apropos of Brexit, to be perfectly honest. But this deal, let's take a step back for a second. This deal that you're talking about that Johnson negotiated with the EU. Again, I'm going to be like, explain Brexit to a fifth grader right now.
Right.
It was nothing nowhere near as detailed as what a former Prime Minister Theresa May had negotiated, right? That was hundreds of pages of actual detail of what Brexit would look like, but that's not what Johnson had. Am I wrong?
No one is ever wrong in Brexit. They're just confused.
Okay.
So it's not, what you said isn't quite accurate. No, I mean so essentially the agreement that Mr. Johnson reached with the European Union is 90% the same as the one agreed by Theresa May. I mean, the way in which Mr. Johnson's agreement was somewhat different is that he had tried to deal with the problem of Northern Ireland by essentially saying something which he said, by the way, he would never do, having a kind of a border internally in the UK between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And the other way in which it was different is that Mr. Johnson envisages, you know, a far more distant relationship between the UK and the European Union after Brexit. But actually, to try and sort of clear things up, because I think it's not well understood anywhere, there are two things involved in Brexit. So there's the bit which is supposed to be the easy bit, which has taken us 3.5 years. Which is the divorce. So that, you know, that deals with issues like, what do you do about Northern Ireland? What do you do about all the EU nationals living here? Any money we might owe the UK, the EU? And then there's the second issue, which is our future relationship, right? And essentially the first one is a legally binding treaty, and the second one is aspirational.
Got it. So the legally binding treaty part being hard enough as it is. So let's forget aspiration.
Exactly. So in many ways, so when, for example, you know, the current government and Mr. Johnson, who, let's remind everyone, led the Vote Leave campaign, when he says, we must get Brexit done, in that very posh voice of his, I mean, in many ways, it's somewhat disingenuous in that, you know, yes, Britain could leave the European Union on the 31st of October, but of course, British politics would still be utterly then consumed by how we should define our future relationship with the European Union. I mean, this baby ain't going anywhere.
Okay, well, so let's listen to a little bit of what the Prime Minister had to say in Parliament on Saturday, because Boris Johnson did respond to the passage of an amendment in Parliament that delayed approval of his Brexit deal. And again, here is the Prime Minister on Saturday.
To anticipate the questions that are coming from the benches opposite, I will not negotiate a delay with the EU. And neither neither does the law compel me to do so. I will tell our friends and colleagues in the EU exactly what I have told everyone in the last 88 days that I've served as Prime Minister, that further delay would be bad for this country, bad for our European Union, and bad for democracy.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Saturday, but Rob Watson, the Prime Minister was in fact required to request an extension from the EU?
He was, and he wrote the letter, but he didn't sign it. And then he sent a second letter. He sent a second letter saying, you know, that letter that I was forced to sign, well, that's a load of old rubbish. We didn't put it quite like that. He said, I think an extension would be really bad idea. And that bit he signed, which prompted one opposition politician to suggest that Boris Johnson write a third letter saying, my name is Boris Johnson, I am 5 years old, and I have been very naughty. So we haven't entirely lost our sense of humour, Meghna.
No. I mean, the English would not be English if in the darkest of times there wasn't at least something to laugh at. But I mean, look, the 31st is 10 days away. What's going to happen, Rob?
Well, it is possible. I mean, if the government introduces the legislation, which we expect them to do, essentially enacting the agreement that the UK reached with the EU last week, I mean, it's not absolutely impossible that the legislation could be passed in time and Britain leaves the European Union on the 31st. I mean, it's also possible that there may have to be a short sort of technical extension while the law was passed. And as I say, the other alternative is that between now and the end of the week or the 31st of October, things just completely collapse because MPs try and interfere, if you like, amend, whatever word you like to use, the legislation. The process collapses and there has to be a general election.
Well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Meredith, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Meredith, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hello, Meredith.
Yeah, go ahead, Meredith.
I am currently residing in Tampa, Florida, and my husband is a British citizen living here in the States with me. And so every time this Brexit vote comes to pass, we are very mindful. You know, we have some property back in England. We also have some savings accounts back in England. We're always watching, okay, is it going to happen this time? My husband was in favor of Brexit prior to Boris Johnson. And now it seems as though Boris Johnson just wants his agenda. He's not very mindful of the people and what they want. And I remember speaking to my husband and some of his British friends, and they voted on Brexit the first go around, and they were asked, what did you really vote on? And they were like, oh, well, we couldn't really tell you. They really didn't know what they were voting on.
Yeah, it just said leave the European Union. That's all it said on the form. Right. Well, Meredith, thank you.
And now...
Yeah, sorry, Meredith. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, it's okay.
Well, I was just going to turn back to Rob Watson here. Meredith, thank you for your call. Rob, I'm wondering, Meredith makes me wonder, Brexit has divided the United Kingdom, but has the view of Brexit changed? Yeah, I mean, has it changed? What does the polling say?
Nothing. Well, look, so the first thing is to say nothing has polarised the UK like Brexit since King versus Parliament in the 17th century. Not that I was around and reporting on that, but I'm reliably informed by historians. The polling suggests that... that if there were a referendum held tomorrow, Remain would win, but not by a landslide. I mean, there hasn't been a fundamental shift. But I want to pick up on Meredith's point because I think it really goes to the heart of the matter of why Britain is in such an almighty mess. I mean, undoubtedly, its biggest political crisis since the Second World War. It's a combination of things. Number one, nobody should be surprised that we're in a political crisis because if you think about it, for the last 40 years, it had been the absolute orthodoxy, the cornerstone of the foreign policy and domestic policy of both Britain's main parties, Labour and Conservative, that we were members of the EU. So it was always going to be very difficult to unscramble it. But to get specifically to what Meredith was saying, you have to understand that the referendum campaign in this country is not like a presidential election or congressional elections in the United States or normal general elections here. We have a party saying, right, this is what we would do if you voted for us. This wasn't like that. I mean, this was a campaign where the vote leave side basically said, let's just leave the European Union. But they weren't a government. I mean, they didn't say, if we win the referendum, you know, this is what we're going to do. It didn't work like that at all. It was just a very brief prospectus. Let's leave. Everything will be better. Well, as their campaign put it, we'll take back control of our laws, our borders and our money. But that was about it.
Mm. This is where I give my obligatory side eye to David Cameron. But let's go to Mike, who's calling from Shaftesbury, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air.
I think that it's an absolute shambles. The original referendum on whether we should be in the EU in the early 70s was quite this clear, and we should be in the EU. And this last referendum 3 years ago.
Mike, I'm so sorry to interrupt. I'm very, very sorry to interrupt, but there sounds like there's more than a little quaver on your line there from Shaftesbury, Vermont. But Rob, what the point that Mike was going to get to is, you know, should there be a people's vote, a so-called people's vote on the conditions of Johnson's Brexit plan? Could that ever happen?
Well, I would say that the numbers aren't quite there in Parliament for it at this stage. I think they're just about a majority of MPs think, you know, while Brexit, I think many of them think Brexit is a thoroughly dumb idea. They think that having another referendum might be even more divisive. But never say never, because actually one of the arguments that it seems to me that's come up in favour of a second referendum, one that their campaign could build on, is this idea that Northern Ireland is going to be treated differently than the rest of the UK. And I think politicians could make an argument that, look, yes, all sorts of silly things were said, economic promises by the Vote Leave campaign, but that perhaps something that really is a bit more egregious is changing a constitutional arrangements for one part of the UK, and that was never told to people during the referendum.
Yeah. Actually, so Rob, I'm glad you brought this up, because I can take my easy pot shots at British politicians until I'm blue in the face, but regarding Northern Ireland, there's something very serious at stake here. I mean, how do people feel in Northern Ireland about where Brexit talks are at the moment?
Well, they're very worried. I mean, people in Northern Ireland, this has been a real ongoing trauma and a crisis. I mean, a trauma in terms of the sort of really fragile peace in that corner of the world, and also kind of deep concern for business about the uncertainty. But again, I suspect it's helpful if I very briefly go back to basics on this one. When Britain voted to leave the European Union, there was always going to be a problem on the island of Ireland, because, you know, people didn't want there to be any kind of border between the Irish Republic, which is staying in the EU, and Northern Ireland. Given the history of violence and the need for people and goods to move freely, that was all part of reaching peace there. So when Britain voted to leave the European Union, there were only really three choices. You could, yes, at the risk to peace, put back hard border there. You could have Britain stay so close to the EU economically that this issue would never arise. Or you could have a border internally in the UK, if you like, between Britain and Northern Ireland. And that's what Mr. Johnson has gone for. And that's why one community in particular in Northern Ireland, and you have to remember, Northern Ireland is contested territory between its Protestants, who most of them would like to stay part of the UK, and its Catholics, who most of them would like a united Ireland. And the Protestant Unionist community think, hang on a minute, at the last minute, we've been sold out by Mr. Johnson.
Mm. Well, Rob, in the last 20 seconds that we have here, I open this segment by saying every Brexit conversation we have, someone says we're in uncharted territory. Are we still in uncharted territory?
I think we left uncharted territory a long time ago and are now sort of sailing away in bits where no man or woman has ever mapped.
So it's the There Be Dragons Here part of the map.
Oh, you betcha.
Well, Rob Watson, BBC World Service, UK political correspondent, speaking to us from London with the latest on Brexit. Rob, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Dow, Mylena Mata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Jeffrey Lyon, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Hello. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.